boys about to take to the water. At 4:45, the first and second place crews from the previous day's trials, California, Pennsylvania, Washington, and the New York Athletic Club, paddled from the Princeton Shell House out onto Lake Carnegie. They made their way under the graceful arches of a stone bridge, around a long, sweeping bend in the lake, and up the straightaway to the starting stalls. The winged footers swung their boat around and backed it into its stall first, then Penn did the same. As Washington tried to back into its stall, a large and recalcitrant white swan blocked the way until Bobby Mauch, yelling at it with his megaphone and waving his arms furiously, finally persuaded it to move slowly aside. Then California backed in. In the late afternoon sun, tall trees growing along the bank cast long shadows over the starting stalls and the boats, but the heat had not abated appreciably. The Washington boys were bare-chested, having stripped off their jerseys just before climbing into their boat. They sat now with their oars in the water, ready for the first hard pull, each staring straight ahead at the neck of the man in front of him, trying to breathe slow and easy, settling their hearts and minds into the boat. Bobby Mauch reached under his seat and touched Tom Bowles's lucky fedora, a few extra ounces of weight in exchange for a lot of luck. A little after 5, the starter called out, "Are you all ready?" All four coxswains raised their hands, and the starting gun flashed immediately. Washington got off to a poor start. 4 or 5 strokes into the race, Gordy Adam and Stug McMillan washed out, their oars popping out of the water before they had completed their pulls. The effect was to throw the boat momentarily out of balance and to abruptly check the crucial momentum that the crew was trying to build up. The other 3 boats surged ahead. On the next stroke, all 8 of the Washington oars caught the water cleanly, perfectly, at once. The New York Athletic Club went briefly to the head of the pack, but Penn, pounding the water at a high cadence of 40 strokes per minute, quickly snatched the lead back. California, rowing at 38, settled into 3rd place, 10 feet in front of Washington's bow. Bobby Mauch and Don Hume took the rate up to 39 to regain momentum, but once that was accomplished, they immediately began to lower it again, to 38, then to 37, then to 36, then to 35. As the rate dropped, the Husky Clipper continued to hold its position just off of California's stern. Out front, Penn was still thrashing the lake white at 39. A quarter of the way down the course, Bobby Mauch found himself creeping up on California. He told Hume to drop the rate yet again, and Hume settled at a surprisingly low 34. As they approached the halfway mark, the New York Athletic Club suddenly began to fade and quickly fell away behind Washington. Penn remained out in front by 3/4 of a length, and even continued to slowly draw farther ahead of California. The Husky Clipper remained stuck on California's tail. The boys continued to row at 34. But what a 34 it was. Don Hume on the port side and Joe Rance on the starboard were setting the pace with long, slow, sweet, fluid strokes, and the boys on each side were falling in behind them flawlessly. From the banks of Lake Carnegie, the boys, their oars, and the Husky Clipper looked like a single thing, gracefully and powerfully coiling and uncoiling itself, propelling itself forward over the surface of the water. 8 bare backs swung forward and backward in perfect unison. 8 white blades dipped in and out of the mirror-like water at precisely the same instant. Each time the blades entered the lake, they disappeared almost without a splash or ripple. Each time the blades rose from it, the boat ghosted forward without check or hesitation. Just before the 1,500-meter mark, Bobby Mauch leaned into Don Hume and shouted, "Here's California! Here's where we take California!" Hume knocked the stroke rate up just a bit to 36, and Washington swiftly walked past Cal, seat by seat. They began to creep up on Penn's stern. Penn's stroke man, Lloyd Saxton, watching the bow of the Husky Clipper coming up behind him, raised his beat to a killing 41. But as Penn's strokes grew more frequent, they began inevitably to grow shorter. Glancing at the puddles Washington's blades left behind in the water, Saxton was shocked at the distance between them. "They were spacing 5 feet to our 3. It was unbelievable," he said after the race. Washington pulled abreast of Penn. But Bobby Mauch still hadn't really turned the boys loose. Coming inside 500 meters, he finally did so. He barked at Hume to pick up the tempo. The rate surged to 39 and then immediately to 40. For 5 or 6 strokes, the bows of the two boats contested for the lead, back and forth, like the heads of racehorses coming down the stretch. Finally, Washington's bow swung decisively out in front by a few feet. From there on, it was, as Gordy Adam would later say, duck soup. With 400 meters to go, Washington simply blew past the exhausted boys from Penn, like an express train passing the morning milk train, swinging into the last few hundred meters with extraordinary grace and power. The last 20 strokes Shorty Hunt wrote to his parents the next day were, "The best I ever felt in any boat." At the finish, they were a full length ahead and still widening the lead. As they crossed the line, Bobby Mock, defying the laws of physics and common sense, suddenly stood bolt upright in the stern of his 24-inch wide shell, triumphantly thrusting one fist into the air. Penn came in second, California third. The New York Athletic Club's shell finally, more or less, drifted across the finish line, 3¾ lengths behind the Washington boat, half her crew lying prone across their oars, having collapsed in the heat. All over Washington State, in smoky little mill towns out on the Olympic Peninsula, on soggy dairy farms nestled up against the Cascades, in posh Victorian homes on Seattle's Capitol Hill, and in the Huskies' drafty shell house down on the Montlake Cut, people stood and cheered. Mothers and fathers rushed off to Western Union offices to send congratulations to their sons back east. Newspapermen frantically scrambled to compose headlines. Bartenders served rounds on the house. What had been a dream was a reality. Their boys were going to the Olympics. For the first time ever, Seattle was going to play on the world stage. Sitting by the radio at Harry Rance's unfinished home on Lake Washington, Joyce and the kids cheered too. Harry said nothing, but suddenly, beaming, he began rummaging around in a box, pulled out a large American flag, tacked it on the wall above the radio, and stood back to admire it. The kids ran off to tell their friends in the neighborhood the good news. Joyce, quietly jubilant, set about cleaning up the peanut shells the kids had let drop on the floor as they listened nervously to the race. A small sadness niggled at the back of her mind. This meant Joe would not be coming home until the end of the summer. But that was a trifle, she knew. And it was swept away by sheer joy as she began to contemplate the prospect of Joe, dressed in an Olympic uniform, climbing off a train in Seattle when he did finally come home in the fall. Flashing broad, white grins, Joe and his crewmates paddled back to the Princeton shell house, tossed Bobby Mock in the water, fished him out, then lined up for the press and newsreel photographers waiting for them on the float. Henry Penn Burke, chairman of the U.S. Olympic Rowing Committee, positioned himself next to Bobby Mock and extended a silver cup to him. As the newsreel cameras whirred, Mock, dripping wet and bare-chested, held one of the cup's handles, and Burke, in a suit and tie, held the other. Then Burke began to speak. He spoke, and he spoke, and he spoke. The boys were tired, and it was blazing hot out on the float, and they wanted to hit the showers and start celebrating. Still, Burke continued to talk. Finally, Mock gave a little tug on the cup, and it popped free from Burke's hand. Burke kept right on talking. Eventually, with Mock clutching the cup, the boys just drifted away, leaving Burke alone on the float, still talking as the newsreel cameras continued to roll. Al Ulbrichtsen also made a few, much briefer, remarks to the press. When asked how he accounted for his varsity success this year, he went straight to the heart of the matter. Every man in the boat had absolute confidence in every one of his mates. Why they won cannot be attributed to individuals, not even to stroke Don Hume. Heartfelt cooperation all spring was responsible for the victory. Ulbrichtsen was no poet. That was Pocock's territory. But the comment was as close as he could come to capturing what was in his heart. He must have known with a kind of certitude that he felt in his gut that he finally had in his grasp what had eluded him for years. Everything had converged. The right oarsmen, with the right attitudes, the right personalities, the right skills. A perfect boat, sleek, balanced, and wickedly fast. A winning strategy at both long and short distances. A coxswain with the guts and smarts to make hard decisions and make them fast. It all added up to more than he could really put into words, maybe more than even a poet could. Something beyond the sum of its parts, something mysterious and ineffable, and gorgeous to behold. And he knew whom to thank for much of it. Walking back to the Princeton Inn that evening with George Pocock, the two men holding their suit coats over their shoulders in the warm, humid twilight, Ulbrichsen stopped suddenly, turned abruptly to Pocock, and extended his right hand. "Thanks, George, for your help," he said. Pocock later remembered the moment. "Coming from Al," he mused, "that was the equivalent of fireworks and a brass band." Later that night, the boys were treated to the annual Loyal Shouty Banquet, where they found the traditional purple necktie and a $5 bill waiting at each place setting. But even as they dined and celebrated, disturbing rumors began to circulate in the hallways of the Princeton Inn. By 8 o'clock, the rumors were confirmed. After his windy speech on the float in front of the Princeton Shell House, Henry Penn Burke had taken Al Ulbrichsen, George Pocock, and Ray Ekman, the athletic director at Washington, into a room and given them, in effect, an ultimatum. If Washington wanted to go to Berlin, the boys were going to have to pay their own way. "You'll have to pay your own freight, or else," Burke said. "We just haven't got the dough." Burke, who was also, coincidentally, the chairman of and a major fundraiser for the Pennsylvania Athletic Club in Philadelphia, went on to say that he understood that Penn had plenty of money, and as the second-place finisher, they would naturally be glad to take Washington's place in Berlin. Similar dramas were playing out across America that week. The American Olympic Committee had come up short of funds. Swimmers, fencers, and dozens of other teams were being asked to finance or partially finance their fare to Berlin. But until this moment, neither the AOC nor the Olympic Rowing Committee had hinted that they would be unable to send the winning crew to the Games. Caught unawares, Ulbrichsen was stunned and livid. The university had already had to beg and scrape every dime it could from alumni and the citizens of Seattle just to send the boys east to Poughkeepsie and Princeton. And there was no chance any of these boys could contribute their own funds. These weren't the heirs and scions of industry. These were working-class Americans. The whole thing stank. The Washingtonians were ready to storm out of the room, but Burke kept on talking. He pointed out that California had paid its own way in 1928 as well as 1932. Yale, he said, had no problem raising private funds in 1924. Surely someone in Seattle could come up with the money. Ulbrichsen knew full well that money more or less grew on the trees at Yale, and that funds had been vastly easier to come by in 1928 before the Depression than in 1936. In 1932, Ebright had been faced only with transporting his crew 350 miles from Berkeley to Los Angeles. Icily, Ulbrichsen asked Burke how much he needed to come up with and how soon. $5,000 by the end of the week, Burke replied. Otherwise, Penn would go. After the meeting, Ulbrichsen huddled with Royal Brougham and George Varnell, and within minutes they were composing headlines and writing special columns to be wired to the Post-Intelligencer and the Times for the next day's editions. In Seattle, a few minutes later, phones began to ring. Ray Ekman called his assistant, Carl Kilgore, who in turn started making local calls. By 10 p.m., Seattle time, Kilgore had enlisted dozens of civic leaders and put a rough plan in place. In the morning, they would open their headquarters at the Washington Athletic Club, name a chairman, and set up teams. In the meantime, everyone began placing more calls. Al Ulbrichsen tried not to alarm his athletes. This was exactly the kind of nonsense he didn't want them fretting about. He told them as little as possible about the funding shortage, and then went to bed that night, believing all would be well. The next morning, Shorty Hunt jotted off a short letter to his parents. "A dream come true. Oh, boy, what lucky kids we are. Nobody can tell me we didn't have old Dame Luck perched on our shoulders." Then he and the rest of the crew chowed down on cantaloupe and ice cream for breakfast before turning out to row in front of Fox Movie Tone's newsreel cameras. A few hours later, Seattleites woke to alarming headlines and radio news bulletins. The entire town went to work. Coeds on summer break grabbed tin cans and began going door to door in their neighborhoods. Paul Coughlin, president of the Alumni Association, started placing calls to some of the university's more prominent graduates. Thousands of lapel tags were quickly printed up, and students on campus for summer session began to sell them for 50 cents apiece in the hallways. Radio announcers broke into their morning programming to appeal for funds. Downtown, I.F. Dix, the general manager of Pacific Telephone and Telegraph, signed on as chairman of the campaign. In short order, telegrams began to rattle out of Dix's office to the chambers of commerce of every city, town, and hamlet in the state. More than 1,000 letters were mailed out to American Legion posts and other civic and fraternal organizations. By afternoon, the money and pledges had begun to pour in. A hefty $500 from the Seattle Times to get things started. $5 from the Hideaway Beer Parlor. $50 from Mighty Standard Oil. $1 from a donor who wished to remain anonymous. $5 from Cecil Blogg of Tacoma, one of Hiram Conabare's coxswains. Money began to come in as well from the boys' hometowns, where their accomplishments had been making local headlines for weeks. $50 from Robbie Mock's Montesano. $50 from Bellingham, the nearest town of any size to the dairy farm on which Gordy Adam had grown up. $299.25 from Don Hume's Olympia. $75 from Joe Rance's Squim. By the end of the first day of the drive, volunteers had sold $1,523 worth of 50-cent tags. At the end of the second day, T.F. Davies, chairman of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, put a $5,000 certified check in an envelope and airmailed it to Al Obrigson. By then, Obrigson and the boys were blithely getting ready to sail for Germany on the SS Manhattan on July 14th. Just hours after the meeting with Harry Penn Burke and his brief conversations with Royal Brougham and George Varnell that evening, Obrigson had put on his best poker face, which is to say his natural face, gone back to Burke and the AOC, and declared that, as a matter of fact, Washington did have the funds to pay its way to Berlin. Then, before anyone could raise any awkward questions about just how he'd managed to get his hands on $5,000 so quickly, he speedily accepted the invitation of the New York Athletic Club to use its training facilities in a nearby suburb on Long Island Sound, and quickly slipped out of Princeton. As the boys, now officially the U.S. eight-oared Olympic rowing team, settled in at Travers Island, they were, largely unbeknownst to them, beginning to become national celebrities. Back home in Seattle, they were already full-blown superstars. Eastern coaches and sports writers had been following them with increasing interest ever since their freshman victory at Poughkeepsie in 1934. And now, after watching those last 20 strokes at Princeton, newspapermen from across the country were starting to put down in print what many of them had first begun to think when they saw Joe and his crewmates emerge suddenly out of the twilight that evening in Poughkeepsie 2 weeks before. These young men just might be the greatest collegiate crew of all time. Travers Island sat on Long Island Sound just south of New Rochelle. The New York Athletic Club's facility there, completed in 1888, sprawled over 30 neatly manicured acres, at the center of which stood a posh, sprawling clubhouse. With a formal dining room and an oyster bar, a billiards room, a full-featured gymnasium, a boathouse, every conceivable sort of athletic training equipment, trap shooting facilities, a baseball diamond, a bowling alley, a boxing ring, tennis courts, squash courts, a cinder running track, Turkish baths, a swimming pool, a barbershop, valet services, and wide, sweeping lawns, it was, for all practical purposes, a country club for amateur athletes, as well as a prominent venue for Westchester County Society events. It afforded easy access to excellent rowing water on the Sound. And, best of all, for boys from the fields, forests, and small towns of the Pacific Northwest, it was just a few miles from all the manifold mysteries and wonders of New York City. The sweltering heat continued to build over the East Coast and over much of America that week, but the boys weren't going to let a little heat keep them from taking a bite of the Big Apple. They visited Grant's Tomb, tried to board the Queen Mary but were turned away, inspected Columbia's campus, toured Rockefeller Center, walked up and down Broadway, and ate at Jack Dempsey's. They trooped into Minsky's Burlesque and came out with wide eyes and sheepish grins, though Johnny White confided his personal opinion in his journal. It was foul. They walked along Wall Street, recalling the hushed tones in which their parents had talked about the place in 1929. They rode the subway out to Coney Island and found that hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers had beaten them there, fleeing the stifling heat of Manhattan, even in the middle of the work week. From the crowded boardwalk, as far as they could see, up and down the shoreline, the beaches were a dark, seething mass of bodies packed together on the sand. They made their way through the throng, fascinated by the thousand voices of New York, Italian-speaking mothers and Spanish-speaking Puerto Rican boys, Yiddish-speaking grandfathers and Polish-speaking girls, giddy children calling out to one another in dozens of tongues and all varieties of English, their voices tinged with the inflections of the Bronx and Brooklyn and New Jersey. They shoveled down 5-cent hot dogs at Nathan's, ate cotton candy, guzzled ice-cold Coca-Colas. They rode on the 150-foot Wonder Wheel and the hair-raising Cyclone roller coaster. They wandered through the spires and turrets of Luna Park, rode more rides, gobbled peanuts, and guzzled more Cokes. By the time they headed back to the city, they were exhausted and not entirely impressed by Coney Island. What a hole, Chuck Day confided in his journal. Dirty, crowded gyp joints. And he wasn't much impressed by the hot, sweltering citizens of Greater New York, either. People in New York are all very tired-looking, pale and soft. The people seldom smile and don't look healthy and full of vigor as out west. As they explored New York, they began to come, one by one, to a new realization about how things stood for them. In Times Square one afternoon, a tall, somewhat heavy man rushed up to Shorty, took a good look, and said, "You're Shorty Hunt." He looked at the other boys. "You fellows are the Washington crew, aren't you?" When they assured him they were, he gushed that he had recognized Shorty from a picture in the newspaper. He was a former Columbia oarsman himself, he said, and after watching their recent exploits, he had decided to send his son west for college, so he too might become a great crewman. It was the first time any of them really began to understand that they were now America's crew, not the University of Washington's, that the W on their jerseys was about to be replaced with USA. For Joe, the moment of epiphany came on the 86th floor of the new Empire State Building. None of the boys had ever ridden an elevator more than a few floors in a hotel, and the rapid ascent both thrilled and frightened them. "Ears popped, eyes bulged," Shorty Hunt wrote home breathlessly that night. Joe had never flown in an airplane, never seen a city from any higher vantage point than that afforded by his own 6'3" frame. Now, standing on the observation deck, he looked out at the many spires of New York rising through a pall of smoke and steam and heat haze, and did not know whether he found it beautiful or frightening. He leaned out over the low stone parapet and peered down at miniature cars and buses and swarms of tiny people scurrying along the streets. The city below him, Joe realized, murmured. The cacophony of honking horns and wailing sirens and rumbling streetcars that had assaulted his ears at street level were reduced up here to something gentler and more soothing, like the sonorous breathing of an enormous, living thing. It was a much bigger, more connected world than he had ever thought possible. He dropped a nickel in a telescope for a better view of the Brooklyn Bridge, then swept across Lower Manhattan and out to the distant Statue of Liberty. In a few days, he would be sailing under her on his way to a place where, as he understood it, liberty was not a given, where it seemed to be under some kind of assault. And the realization that was settling in on all the boys settled on Joe. They were now representatives of something much larger than themselves, a way of life, a shared set of values. Liberty was perhaps the most fundamental of those values, but the things that held them together, trust in one another, mutual respect, humility, fair play, watching out for one another, those were also part of what America meant to all of them. And right along with a passion for liberty, those were the things they were about to take to Berlin and lay before the world when they took to the water at Grunau. Sudden revelation paid Bobby Mock a visit as well. His came as he sat in the shade under a tree in a wide-open field on Travers Island, opening an envelope. The envelope contained a letter from his father, the letter Bobby had requested, listing the addresses of the relatives he hoped to visit in Europe. But the envelope also contained a second sealed envelope labeled, "Read this in a private place." Now, alarmed, sitting under the tree, Mock opened the second envelope and read its contents. By the time he had finished reading, tears were running down his face. The news was innocuous enough by 21st century standards, but in the context of social attitudes in America in the 1930s, it came as a profound shock. When he met his relatives in Europe, Gaston Mock told his son he was going to learn for the first time that he and his family were Jewish. Bobby sat under the tree, brooding for a long while, not because he suddenly found himself a member of what was then still a much discriminated against minority, but because as he absorbed the news, he realized for the first time the terrible pain his father must have carried silently within him for so many years. For decades, his father had felt that in order to make it in America, it was necessary to conceal an essential element of his identity from his friends, his neighbors, and even his own children. Bobby had been brought up to believe that everyone should be treated according to his actions and his character, not according to stereotypes. It was his father himself who had taught him that. Now it came as a searing revelation that his father had not felt safe enough to live by that same simple proposition, that he had kept his heritage hidden painfully away, a secret to be ashamed of, even in America, even from his own beloved son. By July 9th, New York City was baking in the greatest heat wave in American history. For a month, unheard-of temperatures had been searing the West and Midwest. Even the terrible summer of 1934 hadn't been this bad. Now the dome of heat extended from coast to coast and far north into Canada. 3,000 Americans would die of the heat that week, 40 of them in New York City. The U.S. Olympic eight-oared crew was as cool as could be, though. Every afternoon they boarded a boat and made their way out to the New York Athletic Club's private retreat, Huckleberry Island, a mile off Travers Island, out in the cool waters of Long Island Sound. The island was 12 acres of paradise, and the boys fell in love with it the moment they stepped out of their launch and onto a beach in one of its many small granite coves, wearing the Indian headbands with turkey feathers that club members donned whenever they visited the island. They leapt off stone ledges, plunged into the cool green water of the Sound, swam, horsed around, then stretched out on warm, flat slabs of granite, toasting themselves brown before plunging back into the water again. Chuck Day smoked lucky strikes and cracked jokes. Roger Morris lay about looking sleepy, making gruff observations about Day's smoking habit. Gordy Adam was content to bask quietly in the sun wearing his Indian headband. Joe wandered off to study the geology of the island, discovering glacial striations etched in the granite. Bobby Mock tried to organize activities, hustled the boys about, and got unceremoniously tackled and tossed in the water three or four times for his trouble. All of them were at their ease there, comfortable in their skins. With the sea and woods at hand, they were in their element in a way they could never be in Manhattan for all its glitter and glamour. On the third day, Al Ulbrichtsen put the kibosh on their swimming. He was firmly of a mind that any kind of exercise other than rowing was bad for rowers. It developed the wrong sets of muscles. Finally, it came time to pack and prepare for Germany. On July 13th, Pocock supervised the boys as they carefully loaded the 62-foot Husky Clipper onto a long truck and, with a police escort, drove it through the heart of New York City to Pier 60 on the Hudson River, where the SS Manhattan was being ready for its departure 2 days later. Pocock had spent his days at Travers Island carefully sanding down the shell's hull and then applying coat after coat of marine varnish, buffing each coat until the shell glistened. It wasn't just a matter of aesthetics. Pocock wanted the shell to have the fastest possible racing bottom he could impart to it. Fractions of a second might well tell the story in Berlin. When they pulled up alongside the Manhattan, Pocock found that the dock was a jumble of offices, storage sheds, stacks of cargo, and canopied gangways for passengers. He and the boys were responsible for loading the boat onto the ship themselves, and they quickly discovered that there wasn't any place where they could maneuver the long shell into a position to get her aboard. They were all wearing ties for a reception to be followed by dinner at the Lincoln Hotel later that day. Carrying the shell over their heads in the stifling humid heat, they walked carefully but warily up and down the dock for nearly an hour, staring up at the great red hull of the ship, trying everything they could think of. Finally, far up the dock, someone spotted a baggage chute descending at a 60-degree angle to street level. Gingerly, they inserted the prow end of the shell into the chute. Then, crawling on hands and knees, they snaked it up the chute to the promenade deck. From there, holding it high over their heads again, they angled it all the way up to the boat deck, tied it down, covered it with a tarp, and hoped and prayed that no one would mistake it for a bench and sit on it. Then they hurried off to their reception, massively late and soaked in sweat. At the Lincoln Hotel, they signed in officially with the AOC, then mingled for the first time with their fellow Olympians in the lobby. Glenn Cunningham was there, dressed in a sharp gray suit and a bright yellow tie. In a corner of the room, photographers had cornered Jesse Owens, dressed in an ice cream white suit, and talked him into posing with a saxophone. "When I give the word," said one of the photographers, "blow on that thing." On command, Jesse blew. The instrument emitted a long, wheezing sigh. "Better look at your tires, Jesse. That sounded like a puncture," someone joked. Walking around the room, the Washington boys figured they might not be the most famous people there, or the fastest afoot, or even the strongest. But, with the exception of Bobby Mock, they were probably the tallest. Then they met 6'8" Joe Fortenberry and 6'9" Willard Schmidt from the first-ever U.S. Olympic basketball team. When he went to shake their hands and tried to look Schmidt in the eye, even Stubb McMillan found that he risked getting a crick in his neck. Bobby Mock didn't even try. He figured he would have needed a ladder. The next day was a whirl of activity, picking up their Olympic credentials and their German visas, stocking up on a few last-minute sundries, buying traveler's checks. Johnny White didn't know what he was going to do for money in Europe. He still had most of the $14 he'd left home with, but that wasn't going to last long. Then at the last minute, an envelope with $100 arrived from Seattle. His sister Mary Helen had sent it, nearly all her savings, saying she'd take his old violin in exchange. Johnny knew full well she had no interest at all in the violin. They capped off their tour of New York that evening with a trip to Lowe's State Theater, where Duke Ellington and his orchestra were finishing up a week-long engagement. For Joe and Roger especially, it was the highlight of the stay in New York. Under the theater's huge Czech crystal chandelier, sitting in red plush theater seats and surrounded by gilded woodwork, they listened and tranced as Ellington and his orchestra lilted through Mood Indigo, Accent on Youth, In a Sentimental Mood, Uptown Downbeat, and a dozen and a half more tunes. Joe basked in the bright, brassy music, soaking it in as it washed over him, feeling it swing him. Late that night, they settled in at the Alpha Delta Phi Club for one last night's sleep before their even grander adventure commenced the following morning. As they turned out the lights, 50 miles to the south of them, the Zeppelin Hindenburg cast off from its mooring place in Lakehurst, New Jersey, and lumbered out over the Atlantic on its way home to Germany, and its own small role in the 1936 Olympics, looming dark against the night sky, large black swastikas emblazoned on its tail fins. With newsreel cameras rolling and flashbulbs popping, the boys bounded up the gangplank and onto the Manhattan at 10:30 the next morning. Like the 325 other members of the U.S. Olympic team, they were giddy, charged with earnest excitement. None of them had ever been on a boat any larger than the ferries back in Seattle, and the SS Manhattan, 668 feet long, weighing in at 24,289 tons, with 8 passenger decks and able to accommodate 1,239 passengers, was no ferry. She was, in fact, a full-fledged luxury liner. Just 5 years old, she and her sister ship, the SS Washington, were the first large North Atlantic liners to be built in America since 1905, and the largest that Americans had ever built. Lying at berth on the Hudson that morning, the Manhattan was about as all-American a sight as one could imagine, her red hull and gleaming white superstructure topped by twin funnels, each swept jauntily back and painted with red, white, and blue horizontal stripes. As the athletes piled gleefully on board, each was given a small American flag, and soon the rails were crowded with bright-faced young people waving the flags and calling out to family and well-wishers gathered on the dock below. The boys found their quarters down in tourist class and stowed their gear. They met and shook hands with the other oarsmen who would represent the United States in Berlin, Dan Barrow, a single sculler from the Pennsylvania Athletic Club, two pairs, one with and one without a coxswain, also from the Pennsylvania Athletic Club, a double sculls crew from the Undine Barge Club in Philadelphia, and two four-oared crews, one made up of Harvard boys from the Riverside Boat Club in Massachusetts with a coxswain, and one from the Westside Rowing Club in Buffalo, New York, without a coxswain. Then, with the formalities over, they joined the flag wavers up on deck. As the noon sailing time approached, more than 10,000 spectators crowded onto Pier 60. Blimps and airplanes circled overhead. Newsreel photographers shot a few more feet of film on deck, and then scampered off the ship to set up their cameras for shots of it leaving. Black smoke began to billow out of the red, white, and blue funnels. Nautical pennants fluttered from rigging on the fore and after masts in a light, hot breeze. Just before noon, the athletes assembled on the sun deck, gathering around Avery Brundage and other AOC officials as they unfurled an enormous white flag with the five interlocking Olympic rings and began to raise it on the aftermast. The crowd on the dock, doffing their hats and waving them over their heads, began a thunderous chant, "Ray, ray, ray for the USA!" A band struck up a martial tune, the lines were cast off, and the Manhattan began to back slowly out into the Hudson. Joe and the other boys rushed back to the rails, waving their flags now, unabashedly taking up the chant, "Ray, ray, ray for the USA!" On the dock, people shouted, "Bon voyage!" The whistles on tugs and ferries and nearby ships began to shriek. Out on the river, fireboats let loose with their sirens and shot white plumes of water high into the air. The planes overhead tipped to one side and circled in tight loops as photographers snapped aerial views. Tugs pushed the bow of the Manhattan until she pointed down the river, and the ship began to power majestically down the west side of Manhattan. As she made her way past the Battery, Joe felt the first cooling breeze in days. When she passed Ellis Island, and then the Statue of Liberty, he, like everyone, dashed to the starboard rail to watch her pass. He stayed on deck as the ship made her way through the Narrows, with Staten Island on one side and Brooklyn on the other, and then progressed through the lower bay and out finally into the Atlantic, where she began to roll slightly as she made a long, slow, sweeping turn to port. Still, Joe stayed on deck, leaning on the rail, enjoying the cool air, watching Long Island pass by, trying to absorb everything, to remember everything, so he could tell Joyce all about it when he returned home. It was only hours later, when the sun had begun to decline in the west and Joe had finally grown downright chilly on deck, that he retreated into the bowels of the ship, starting to get his sea legs, looking for the rest of the boys, and food. As the Manhattan sailed northeast that night and darkness enveloped her, she was ablaze with lights and loud with music, alive with the laughter of young people at play, having the time of their lives, venturing out onto the black void of the North Atlantic, on their way to Hitler's Germany. Chapter 16. Good thoughts have much to do with good rowing. It isn't enough for the muscles of a crew to work in unison. Their hearts and minds must also be as one. George Yeoman Pocock. As Joe drifted into sleep aboard the Manhattan, the first light of dawn crept over Berlin, revealing small groups of men, women, and children being marched through the streets at gunpoint. The arrests had begun hours earlier, under the veil of night, when police and SA stormtroopers broke into the shanties and wagons that were home to Roma and Sinti families, gypsies, and rousted them from their beds. Now they were on their way to a sewage disposal site in the Berlin suburb of Marjan, where they would be kept in a detention camp, well away from the eyes of foreigners arriving in Berlin for the Olympics. In time, they would be sent east to death camps and murdered. Their removal was just one more step in a process that had been unfolding for months as the Nazis transformed Berlin into something resembling a vast movie set, a place where illusion could be perfected, where the unreal could be made to seem real and the real could be hidden away. Already the signs prohibiting Jews from entering public facilities had been taken down and stored for later use. The fiercely anti-Semitic Der Stürmer newspaper, with its grotesque caricatures of Jews and its slogan, "The Jews are our misfortune," had been temporarily removed from newsstands. In Der Angriff, his principal propaganda publication, Joseph Goebbels had handed Berliners the script for their part in the performance, detailing how they should conduct themselves toward Jews and how they should welcome the foreigners when they arrived. "We must be more charming than the Parisians, more easygoing than the Viennese, more vivacious than the Romans, more cosmopolitan than London, more practical than New York." When the foreigners arrived, all would be pleasant. Berlin would become a sort of benign amusement park for adults. Strict controls would limit what visitors could be charged for everything, from rooms at luxury hotels like the Adlon to the bratwurst sold by street vendors all over town. To improve the scenery, not only the gypsies, but more than 1,400 homeless people had been collected and removed from the streets. Hundreds of prostitutes had been seized, forcibly examined for venereal disease, and then turned loose to ply their trade for the carnal satisfaction of the visitors. Visiting journalists, who would convey their impressions of the new Germany to the rest of the world, would be given special accommodations, the finest equipment, the best vantage points for viewing the games, free secretarial services. There was one contingency, though, that would have to be handled delicately, should it arise. If foreign journalists attempted to interview German Jews or investigate the Jewish question, they were to be politely directed to the nearest Gestapo office so that they could be questioned as to their intentions, and then trailed secretly. Along the railroad tracks on which the visitors would travel into Berlin, grimy buildings had been whitewashed, vacant apartment buildings had been rented out inexpensively, and identical window boxes full of red geraniums had been placed beneath windowsills of even the apartments that remained vacant. Virtually every home along the tracks now displayed the red, white, and black swastika flag. Many also flew the white Olympic flag. A few, mostly Jewish homes, flew only the Olympic banner. Thousands more swastika flags hung in railroad stations. Indeed, all of Berlin was draped with swastikas. Along the central promenade on Unter den Linden, Berlin's wide central boulevard, the hundreds of linden trees that had given the street its name had been replaced with regimented colonnades of flagpoles bearing enormous 45-foot red banners with swastikas. Equally tall banners hung from the Brandenburg Gate. At Adolf Hitlerplatz, concentric rings of tall masts flying Olympic flags surrounded a central tower 62 feet high, draped with 20 swastika flags, forming a dramatic blood-red cylinder in the middle of the grassy square. On the pleasant, shady streets leading to the rowing course out in Grunau, strands of smaller flags with swastikas were strung from tree to tree. The streets had been swept and reswept, shop windows polished, trains freshly painted, broken windows replaced. Dozens of new courtesy Mercedes limousines had been parked in neat rows outside the Olympic Stadium, awaiting VIPs. Nearly everyone, from taxi drivers to sanitation workers, had been outfitted in some kind of smart new uniform. Foreign books, banned books, books that had escaped the bonfires of 1933, suddenly reappeared in bookshop windows. With the set fully decorated, Leni Riefenstahl was busily at work mobilizing dozens of cameramen and sound technicians, putting scores of cameras in place. In the Olympic Stadium, out at the Reichssportfeld, she set up 30 cameras for the opening ceremony alone. She dug pits for low-angle shots and erected steel towers for high-angle shots. She constructed rails on which camera dollies could run alongside the red clay track. She immersed cameras in waterproof housings in the Olympic swimming and diving pools. She attached cameras to saddles for equestrian events and floated them on pontoon boats for swimming events. In central Berlin, she set cameras on strategic buildings, mounted them on the tops of trucks, suspended them from blimps, and dug more pits, all to capture ground-level footage of the marathon runners and the torch relay runners as they made their way through the city. Out at the rowing course at Grunau, she constructed a jetty in the Langersee, running parallel to the race course, and installed rails along which a dolly with a camera could follow the shells for the final 100 meters of the races. She borrowed an anti-aircraft balloon from the Luftwaffe and tethered it near the finish so a cameraman could dangle from it for aerial shots. Everywhere she set up cameras, Riefenstahl made sure she had the most flattering angles, generally cast upward, for filming the ultimate stars of the show, Adolf Hitler and his entourage. Then, with the cameras mostly in place, she and all of Berlin waited for the rest of the cast to arrive. Don Hume and Roger Morris lay retching in their berths aboard the Manhattan that morning. Al Ulbrichtsen felt fine, but he was worried about Hume and Morris, laid low by seasickness. They were already the two lightest oarsmen in the boat, and he had planned to make sure they put on some weight during the voyage. Joe Rance woke up feeling great. He made his way up to the promenade deck, where he found a riot of athleticism unfolding. Live gymnasts twirled on parallel bars and uneven bars and took long running leaps at pommel horses, trying to time their precise movements to coincide with the slow roll of the ship. Stout weightlifters hoisted enormous hunks of iron over their heads, quivering and swaying slightly beneath their loads. Boxers sparred in a makeshift ring, dancing to keep their feet under them. Fencers lunged. Sprinters jogged by, running slow laps, taking care not to turn an ankle. In the ship's small saltwater swimming pool, coaches had tied rubber ropes to their swimmers, keeping them in place as they swam, and making sure they didn't get sloshed onto the deck when particularly large waves rolled the boat. Rifle shots cracked from the stern as decathletes fired their weapons out over the empty ocean. When the gong sounded for men's breakfast, Joe went to his assigned table and was disappointed to find that athletes were permitted to order only from a special restricted menu, designed, apparently, to feed canaries or coxswains. He ate everything he could order and tried to order seconds, but was denied. He left the room nearly as hungry as he entered it. He resolved to talk to Ulbrichtsen about it. Meanwhile, he had a look around. Below decks, he found a gymnasium full of exercise apparatus, a children's playroom, barbershops, a manicure shop, and a beauty salon. He discovered a comfortable lounge in tourist class, complete with a screen for what were then still often called talking pictures. All of it seemed pretty swell to Joe. But when he ventured up on the first-class decks, he found another world entirely. The cabins there, paneled in exotic woods, were spacious, with built-in vanities, plush upholstered furniture, Persian rugs, bedside telephones, and private bathrooms with hot and cold freshwater showers. Joe wandered quietly on plush carpeting through a maze of corridors, leading to a full cocktail bar, then a cigar shop, then a writing room, and then a library with oak paneling and heavy beams. He found a smoking lounge with a wood-burning fireplace that stretched the width of the room, and murals and carvings meant to suggest that the smoker had entered an Aztec temple. He found the Veranda Café, its walls painted with Venetian scenes and featuring a large elliptical dance floor. He found the Chinese palm court, complete not only with live palm trees, but high white-plastered rococo ceilings, marble columns, delicate hand-painted Asian wall murals, and Chippendale furniture. He found the first-class dining room, with its own orchestra balcony, cove lighting behind recessed windows to create the illusion of perpetual daylight, and round dining tables, each draped with elegant tablecloths and carrying its own Louis XVI-style brass lamp, all arranged under a domed ceiling painted with murals of mythological scenes like the Feast of the Bacchanalia. And finally he found the Grand Salon, featuring its own theatrical stage and talking picture screen, with more Persian rugs, formal divans and armchairs, fluted walnut pilasters, hand-carved molding, wide windows hung with velvet curtains, and another high, domed rococo plaster ceiling. Joe tried to look inconspicuous, or as inconspicuous as a 6'3" boy could look. He wasn't, technically speaking, supposed to be wandering around in such places. The athletes were expected to remain in the tourist class areas, except when exercising on the promenade deck during daylight hours. This was intended to be the province of the sort of people Joe had seen on the golf course at Princeton, or on the manicured lawns of the estates he had glimpsed up the Hudson. But Joe lingered, mesmerized by his peek at how the other half still lived. When he returned to his cabin, he found something waiting for him that made him feel pretty classy himself. In New York, the boys had been measured for their Olympic outfits, and now Joe found a double-breasted blue serge sports coat and matching blue slacks spread out on his bunk. The coat had the U.S. Olympic shield emblazoned on the breast and bright brass buttons, each with a miniature shield. There was a pair of white flannel slacks, a white straw boater with a blue hatband, a crisp white dress shirt, white socks with red, white, and blue edging, white leather shoes, and a blue striped necktie. There was a blue sweatsuit with USA printed boldly across the chest, and there was a rowing uniform, white shorts, and an elegant white jersey with a U.S. Olympic shield on the left breast and white, red, and blue ribbons stitched around the neck and down the front. For a boy who had worn the same rumpled sweater to rowing practice for a year, this was an astonishing collection of sartorial treasure. The fabric of the jersey was smooth, almost like silk, and it shimmered in the afternoon light streaming in through his porthole when he held it up for a better look. He had never yet been beaten, had never been obliged to surrender a jersey to a rival oarsman. He had no intention of letting this jersey be the first. He was taking this one home. Over the next few days, Don Hume and Roger Morris slowly recovered from their seasickness, and the boys began to roam the boat together. They found a rowing machine on deck and tried it out, posing on it for news photographers. Al Ulbrichtson posed with them, but when the photographers were done, he quickly chased the boys off the apparatus, saying, as he often did, that the only proper way to develop rowing muscles was by rowing in a real shell. As they wandered away, Roger Morris gave him a grin over his shoulder and said, "Heck, if you want us to row in a shell, just lower the clipper over the side and we'll row the rest of the way over." When Ulbrichtson wasn't watching, they ran laps around the deck, worked out in the gym, played shuffleboard and ping-pong with other athletes, and got on a first-name basis with a few who already were or would soon be household names, among them Ralph Metcalf, Jesse Owens, and Glenn Cunningham. Johnny White went prowling for girls and returned unhappy with the prospects, and except for Don Hume, all of them began to put on weight. Al Ulbrichtson had talked to someone in the galley and someone on the AOC, making the case that a menu suitable for a 13-year-old gymnast might not be appropriate for a 6'4 oarsman, explaining that a boatload of skeletons was not likely to win any medals. The strict menu restrictions had promptly been lifted, and the boys began more or less living in the tourist-class dining salon. Free now to order anything from the menu as often as they wanted, except for sugary desserts or items excessively high in fat, they did just that, eating helping after helping of the main courses, just as they had on the train to Poughkeepsie. They were the first of the athletes to sit down and the last to get up, and no one, with the possible exception of Louis Zamperini, the long-distance runner from Torrance, California, out-ate Joe Rance. Stubb McMillan gave it a try, though. One morning he sneaked into the dining salon ahead of the rest of the crew. He ordered 2 stacks of hotcakes, slathered them with butter, drowned them with syrup, and was just about to dig in when Al Ulbrichtson entered the room. Ulbrichtson sat down, cocked an eye at the plate, slid it to his side of the table, and said, "Thanks a million, Jim, for fixing those for me," and slowly devoured both stacks as McMillan glowered at him over a plate of dry toast. After dinner each evening there were more formal entertainments. A variety show, an amateur hour, mock trials and mock weddings, bingo games, checkers and chess tournaments, and a casino night during which the athletes waged stage money. There were raucous sing-alongs and a captain's ball for which everyone was given balloons and noisemakers and party hats. There was a formal debate on the always contentious proposition that the East is a better place to live than the West. Talking pictures were shown in the tourist lounge for the athletes and in the grand salon for first-class passengers. The Washington boys didn't think much of the class business, though, and they flouted it. They soon discovered that when five or six big oarsmen sat down in the Grand Salon and they just happened to be Olympic athletes representing the United States of America, there wasn't much anybody was going to do about it. So they took to visiting the upper decks for their movie viewing, stopping each evening on their way into the Grand Salon to swipe one of the large platters of hors d'oeuvres, and then passing it around as they watched the show. It soon became clear, though, that there were limits beyond which one could not transgress on the Manhattan. Eleanor Holm was 22 years old, beautiful, married, and a minor celebrity, having performed bit parts in several Warner Brothers movies. She was somewhat notorious for having sung "I'm an Old Cow Hand" in a cabaret while wearing only a white cowboy hat, a white swimsuit, and high heels. She was also a very good swimmer, and had won a gold medal at the 1932 Olympics in Los Angeles. Now she was widely favored to win the 100-meter backstroke in Berlin. On the second day out of New York, a group of journalists invited her up to the first-class decks for what turned out to be an all-night party, during which she drank a good deal of champagne, ate caviar, and entranced many of the writers, among them William Randolph Hearst, Jr. By 6 o'clock the next morning, she was dead drunk and had to be carried back to her cabin in tourist class. When she came to, she was summoned into the presence of Avery Brundage, who read her the riot act and told her he would throw her off the team if she continued drinking. She did. Several nights later, she again attended a party held by the hard-drinking news writers. This time, the swim team chaperone, Ada Sackett, caught her in the act. In the morning, Sackett and the ship's surgeon awoke a badly hungover Holm in her cabin. The surgeon took one look at her and pronounced her an alcoholic. Dee Beckman, coach of the women's team, then marched a number of Holmes's teammates through the cabin, pointed at the pale, disheveled, and retching Holm, and expounded on the diabolical effects of alcohol. Later that day, Avery Brundage expelled Holm from the U.S. Olympic team. Holm was devastated, and many of her fellow athletes were outraged. Some felt that Holm had been deliberately set up by the journalists in order to manufacture a story. Others felt that she had been dropped not so much for drinking as for defying Brundage. Although the athlete's handbook prohibited drinking, Brundage had convened a meeting of the entire U.S. team on the first day out of New York and told them that the matter of eating, smoking, and drinking was one of individual judgment. And indeed, Brundage later wrote that Holm had been removed partly for insubordination. More than 200 of Holmes's fellow athletes signed a petition asking that she be reinstated. All of them knew that, in fact, alcohol was widely available and widely used below decks. In fact, even as Holm and the writers were partying up in first class, Chuck Day and some of his mates were holding their own all-nighters down in tourist class, merrily mixing milk, Ovaltine, and alcohol. But discipline was sacrosanct for Brundage. The Eleanor Holm story, as at least some of the journalists had calculated, made headlines for days back in the United States, and in the long run, it did wonders for her career. In the wake of Prohibition, many Americans were sick and tired of hearing about the dangers of demon rum, and the press coverage was largely sympathetic to Holm. Alan Gould of the Associated Press promptly hired her to cover the Berlin Olympics as a reporter, though in fact her pieces would be ghostwritten. Within a few years, she would land roles in major feature films and appear on the cover of Time magazine. The story made headlines in Europe as well, and it caught the eye of Joseph Goebbels, who found himself decidedly in accord with Brundage's thinking. It wasn't herself who mattered. It was the others, and discipline. "For that, no sacrifice is too great, no matter how many tears are shed," proclaimed a statement from the Ministry of Propaganda. By the night of July 21st, the boys could see the glimmer of lighthouses on the southwest coast of Ireland. At 3 the next morning, the Manhattan put into the small port of Cobb. From there, she proceeded around the Cornish coast to Plymouth, and then across the channel to Le Havre, where she arrived early on the morning of July 22nd. The boys were not allowed off the ship, but they spent much of the day at the railings on deck, watching French longshoremen load and unload cargo. This was the first good look at Europe any of them had ever had, and they were intrigued by simple details. The crumbling old buildings, French women on bicycles carrying loaves of bread as long as their arms, boys in jaunty berets, men at work on the docks, stopping periodically to drink some wine, in no apparent hurry to complete their tasks. That night, they sailed up the channel with the lights of Calais blazing brightly to the east. By dinner time on July 23rd, they were finally in Germany. At Cuxhaven, a motor launch flying Nazi flags pulled alongside the ship to take off German news writers and photographers who had boarded at Le Havre. The Manhattan started up the Elbe River toward Hamburg just at dawn.